Well, we're now in front of Eden Ravenscroft. You can see by the date above, they've been supplying wigs and gowns to the legal profession for over 300 years, and also supplying gowns for people at graduation ceremonies. But in front of you, you've got three wigs in the window. The most prominent, of course, is the full bottom wig, or the big wig. That's how it is. You're the big wig, you're the Lord Chancellor, you're the Chief Justice, whatever it is. Those are worn for special occasions now only, but the other one you can see there is the bench wig, or sometimes called bob wig, and that's what most judges wear when they're in court. Everyday judge wear. And on the left-hand side, you can see the bar wig, or the barrister's wig, or the forensic wig, sometimes called. Now, these used to be made of human hair, and they were powdered with a very expensive hair powder. So William Pitt the Younger introduced a tax on hair powder. So people resorted to using flour from the kitchen and ash from the fire and stuff like that. But these are made of South American horsehair, very high quality, and all hand-curled using Eden Ravenscroft's own patent technique. Now the bar or barrister's wig will take you back about £850, and the full bottom wig, the big wig, at least £3,000. So quite expensive, but they'll last you your professional life. Now, as a barrister, you have to be seen in court wearing the wig, the wing collar, the bands or the tabs, black waistcoat, black gown, black clothing basically, and black shoes. And if you don't wear this, you are, in the eyes of the law, inaudible and invisible. A barrister once stood up in court, it was the 1920s, his waistcoat was at the cleaners, and he was wearing a yellow one instead of a black one. And he started talking, and the judge said, I cannot see you or hear you, Mr. Tuffington Smythe. He said, I'm sorry, my lad. I cannot see you or hear you. I said, well, hello. He started waving from side to side and waving. The judge said, no. Look down, look down. He said, oh, yes. Is it my yellow waistcoat that your honour cannot see? The judge said, yes. Well, you can see the rest of me. Can we carry on, please? And he won the argument and they carried on. But you're supposed to wear this kind of gear. Some people think it's quite ridiculous. I mean, Tony Blair, when he was a young barrister, hated wearing all this fancy dress, but others say it lends an air of formality and solemnity to the court. And the old idea was you recognise who's who. I mean, there's the judge with the big wig, and there's the QC, the Queen's Counsel, with a silk gown, which is slightly shorter than the others. And they had a vote in the profession some years ago to get rid of it. The older barristers wanted it out, but the younger ones wanted it kept in. Because at the start of your career, do a great little criminal work, and hopefully your clients won't recognise you if you're not dressed up in this kind of disguise. Anyway, it's being retained still. It's a nice piece of English eccentricity. Sometimes if you want to save money, you can, of course, a young barrister, you can buy a wig second-hand on eBay, or wear your great-grandfather's wig. I mean, there are some young barristers see standing up, and they're yellow, and these wigs, and falling apart, and one of the clerks said to me, you know, some of these wigs are distinct health hazards. They've not been cleaned for about 300 years. But the dirtier your wig is, the more experienced you appear. There's an old story about this. There's an old lag. He was always up in front of the judge for things like breaking and entering and drunkards had already breached the peace. He had a choice of young barristers who were doing their pro bono work, you know, work without fee. And he saw all these white wigs, he said to the clerk, yeah, don't want none of them white wigs defending me. He saw a grey wig come to the back. He said, yeah, I'll have that one over there, the grey one. The clerk said, we can't have him, it's the prosecution. He said, oh, righto, I'll plead guilty. Anyway, so you can impress all the neighbours by getting dressed up like this if you want to. Don't have to be a lawyer to do this. You can, the full bottom stuff, the full bottom wig, that's worn for special occasions, things like state opening of Parliament, and other matters like that. And there was a case of a Lord Chancellor striding across the lobby and wearing all this gear, and there's a Member of Parliament called Neil Kinnock who was showing some American visitors around, and as the man strode across the lobby, he saw Neil Kinnock and he called out and said, ah, he said, Neil! All the American visitors did, very gratifying. Anyway, yes, sometimes the wig is worn for a special occasion, and there was a special assize once, and the judge was wearing the full bottom wig, and there was a punk rocker in the witness box, and the punk rocker had blue spiky hair and safety pins all over his face, and the judge, wearing the full bottom wig, the red gown and silk stockings and buckled shoes, said to the punk rocker, "Have you any idea how ridiculous you look?" Anyway, let's move on now to the back street here. This is Carey Street. Carey Street has an unfortunate association because the bankruptcy court is in it. And if you're in Carey Street, you're in financial trouble. So walking down Carey Street, we've got a rather palatial building in front of us now. This is the back end of the Royal Courts of Justice. This is civil cases, so it's things like bankruptcy, it's contract law, it's libel, it's slander, and it's inquiries. You might recall the Hutton inquiry, where it was alleged that Alistair Campbell, Tony Blair's chief spin doctor, had altered or sexed up an intelligence dossier to make the war in Iraq look more plausible. And it was a big scandal, and there were newsmen and paparazzi everywhere about this, and some French television man was here, and this BBC representative came and said, "Hello, what are you doing here?" And this man said, "Well, we heard this extraordinary story about how a British government minister has sexed up a document. The thought of an Englishman sexing up anything is remarkable. That's why we're here." So you very often find them hanging around like flies outside the courtroom entrance, waiting for the next victim to appear. And there was the Levinson inquiry here about press misbehaviour, where Hugh Grant was a witness. And there was even the divorce proceedings between Paul McCartney and his Heather Mills. And at the end of the case, you realised you're not going to get the full £800 million. And in extreme anger, grabbed a large jug of drinking water and threw it over her husband's solicitor. Came up with a very different hairstyle. But we also had, besides those two inquiries, the Diana inquest, where Mohammed Al-Fayed had alleged that MI6 was used, along with Prince Philip, to assassinate Princess Diana, which is after spending £10.5 million of public money, which turned to be complete nonsense. Now, if you are here again, there's some. If you look down the street, you'll find there's a very attractive pub down there called the Seven Stars. You can just see it with its black sign and the seven stars on. It's a lovely old-fashioned barrister's pub, well worth a look. And in it is a cat called Al Brown, who wears a white frilled collar and sits on a chair and effectively runs the pub. I mean, even the animals around here are correctly dressed. Anyway, they go down Bell Yard here, past the Law Society building, and then we'll cross over Fleet Street. We've now crossed Fleet Street, and there's a half-turbid building in front of us. Dates from the 17th century, one of the few buildings to survive the Great Fire. And we'll go through this arch, coming down into Inner Temple Lane. And just in front of us, you can see there's an old church. This is the Temple Church, one of the oldest churches in London. This was consecrated by Heraclitus, Patriarch of Jerusalem, in 1185. And it's one of the churches built for the group called the Knights Templar. I mentioned them, I think, at the beginning of this walk, this band of fighting monks whose idea was to make Jerusalem safe for Christians. Now, if you were a knight in the Middle Ages and you're riding around, you fancy travelling still further. If you're in France, you go to the Church of Saint-Sulpice and you get yourself a credit note. Once you've got a credit note, you then travel to England and you ride through to the Temple Church and you cash your credit note, rather like cashing a traveller's cheque at a bank. So the Templars really were bankers for medieval England in some respects. They had a great deal of independence, answerable only to the Pope, and they incurred a great deal of royal jealousy. Now, Philip the Fair of France, the title Philip the Fair refers to colour of his hair, not his behaviour, accused of witchcraft and appalling sexual practices, had them all arrested on Friday the 13th of October 1307. So Friday the 13th traditionally became the unlucky day. Executed in France, persecuted here as well. The church was emptied and given to the Knights Hospitallers of St. John, and they in turn gave it to the lawyers. So it's now very much the lawyers' church. Anybody seen the Da Vinci Code or read the book? You have walked where Tom Hanks walked. How awesome is that? And they filmed it. They filmed this scene where they go inside and try to find a particular tomb of the Knights Templar. So they're filmed here with Tom Hanks and Audrey Tautou and Paul Bettany and Ian McKellen. As a result of all this filming, they charged a great deal of money to use that church. The church has now been restored, so thank you, Dan Brown. I think the vicar is looking for Da Vinci Code too. Incidentally, the vicar's house is just over there. You can see a large green gable there, and he is known as the Master of the Temple. And he's appointed not by the Archbishop of Canterbury or the Bishop of London, but by the Queen. So it's a royal appointment. So this is very much an establishment place. The people who lie buried here told King John in 1215 at Runnymede, "Oi, sign on that line." They limited the power of the monarch. Very powerful people indeed. Now, if you go inside, you'll find the effigies of the knights with their legs crossed over and swords withdrawn. It's a piece of medieval England still left in the centre of London. So as we go down, we can see a lot of boards outside various doors, and these have the names of the barristers who have their chambers there. Chambers are sets of rooms where they set facilities and where you consult with clients. Right at the top, you see the name Mr. Mark Love. He is the head of chambers. And your eye travels down, and then you come to Mr. Simon Tolkien, who, of course, only defends hobbits. But let your eyes travel down still further, and you've got the name Mr. Lavelle. He is the clerk, the senior clerk. Now, the clerks effectively run the show. Let's say, for example, you go to your solicitor and say, "Look, this man's written a book about me, it's libelous, what do we do?" You talk to the correspondence with the publisher, no joy there. You talk to a solicitor of the publisher, no joy, say, "Right, we will now consult with counsel." So you go here and the lawyer will say, the barrister will say yes or no, we can go into court, and then the financial meter really starts ticking over. My advice to all of you is settle out of court every time. Saves a lot of time and money. Anyway, so the case is prepared by the solicitor. It's called the brief. And if you look up in the window there, you can see bundles of white documents wrapped around with pink ribbon. Now, pink ribbon, those are the briefs. Pink ribbon equals red tape. That's where we get the expression red tape from. Too many regulations, like kind of too much red tape. Okay, let's go around the other side of the church and we'll drop a few names. Oh, incidentally, while we're here, you can see the name Goldsmith. Now, Oliver Goldsmith, the Anglo-Irish writer who wrote The Vicar of Wakefield and She Stoops to Conquer, lies buried here. And behind us is Dr. Johnson's building. So Dr. Johnson actually lived here for a time. Didn't think very much of lawyers, though. He said, "I don't like to speak ill of anybody, but I understand the fellow is an advocate." Or as another name, not mentioned here, not in writing, that is, but certainly remembered in fond memory. Number one, Dr. Johnson's buildings, was the chambers of John Mortimer, QC. John Mortimer created Horace Rumpole, Rumpole of the Bailey. Wonderful character. A small barrister who smokes small cheroots, never gets promoted to anything. And one quote is, "My alcohol level, being dangerously low, reverted to Pomeroy's, where there I consumed half a gallon of Chateau Thames Embankment. Finally home to Hilda, she who must be obeyed." Great character. Now, some other characters around the next corner. You can see, by the way, the sign of Inner Temple, where we are, shows a horse with two wings. But it used to show this. Now, you see that column? You've got a horse there with two men on it. So it was a horse with two Knights Templar, not a horse with two wings originally. This demonstrated, they claimed, the Knights Templar's modesty, brotherhood, and thrift in using one horse as a vehicle, and if one brother was injured in battle, the other would take the other to safety. Others said it merely illustrated all his Knights Templars were homosexual. There you are, one Bahamut and the other. Complete rubbish, the whole thing. All royal spin. Anyway, coming through the arch, we come down, there's a whole long line of chambers here. And you see this one here, it has the name the Right Honourable Anthony Blair. So Tony Blair has his name written here, although he no longer practices as a barrister. It's a question of honour because he came to the rank of Prime Minister. And you see also the name Derry Irvine of Laigh. He was Tony Blair's Lord Chancellor. He was the one who introduced Cherie and Tony for the first time, and he got the job as Lord Chancellor in Tony Blair's government. Jobs for Cupid, it was alleged. And when they first met, apparently, there was no real chemistry. In fact, they were rivals for a place in chambers. And there was a Christmas party arranged. And there they were in their glad rags and makeup. And you know that daft game where you've got a balloon where you try to transfer it between dancing couples? And Tony and Cherie were shuffling drunkenly around the room and they fell over and the balloon went pop. And later intimacy took place on the number 74 bus going home. And Tony Blair said to a friend, "No, it's amazing. When people take off their working clothes, they look completely different." Anyway, she helped Tony out with his studies, apparently. And when Cherie took the bar final, she got the highest mark for the whole country. In front of you is the rebuilt dining hall. And it's here, the old dining hall. And this had to be rebuilt because of bombing in World War II, but the old dining hall was a young man who'd come from South Africa to study law. His name was Mohandas, later Mahatma Gandhi. He was very popular with the law students because he didn't drink alcohol, and free wine was provided with dinners, so people just come along and grab his bottle and run off with it. And he was amidst all this alcoholic mayhem. This old chap came and said, rather patronisingly, "Oh, hello, Mr. Gandhi. Do tell me, what do you think of Western civilization?" And Gandhi said, "I think it'd be a very good idea." Other names from here include Michael Howard, who was a QC and became leader of the Conservative Party, and Abraham, otherwise known as Bram Stoker, author of Dracula. But, oh, now, there's something about Mortimer I'd like to mention. And John Mortimer created this great character, Horace Rumpole, and we're going around the country doing sort of after-dinner speeches and stuff, talking about his experience as a barrister. Got into a taxi once, and the taxi driver said, "Yeah, hello, are you Mortimer?" He said, "Yes, that's me. I was on one of your juries once." "Oh, really? That's very interesting. What was the case?" "Yes, I remember that case. You got my man off. You went off scot-free. That was very generous of you." "Do you know what?" I said, "You're the only barrister who wished us good morning when you came in. Never mind the evidence. Schmooze the jury. Get your man off." He was also defending a recidivist once. His man was hopeless, and the judge said, "It's ridiculous. You've been in court about 25 times in your life. Last time almost killed somebody. I'm giving you 10 years. He said, "10 years? Here you go. I'm 76. I'll be dead before I come out. Well, do as many years as you can then." Best one, though, is the case of indecent exposure. Mortimer used to tell us a lot. And there was a case of a very genteel middle-class lady in the witness box. And the prosecution said, "Now, you tell the court what he, the accused, said to you then." Little old lady went, "Oh, no, I couldn't say that." John said, "I'm sorry, madam, why can't you tell us?" "Well, because of what he said. It was extremely rude. It was disgusting." John said, "Now look, madam, it's a court of law. We hear all sorts of ridiculous things. It's perfectly right. I can tell us exactly what he said." "Oh, no, I couldn't say that." John said, "Right. Said to the clerk, would you pass this lady a piece of paper? Would you write down what this man said to you on a piece of paper, pass it to the lawyers, it'll come to the jury, it'll convince you, we've all seen it." The paper's passed to her, and she wrote down, "Do you fancy a screw?" Barristers made a note. Around the jury it went. The penultimate juror, a very attractive young woman, read it. And the last juror was an elderly gentleman during all of this, had been fast asleep, and so she nudged him awake and passed the piece of paper, and he looked at him and started grinning. And he folded the paper out and put it in his pocket. Judge said, "Oh, just a minute, I need to read that." He said, "Oh, it's a private matter," he said. Good story. We've now moved on to the last of the inns. This is Middle Temple, a magnificent hall which dates from the 16th century. And you can see the lamb and flag above the front door. Now, the lamb and flag is a crusader's emblem. It's the Paschal Lamb of Easter. If you're familiar with the Latin Mass, Agnus Dei qui tollis peccata mundi, the Lamb of God that takes away the sins of the world. And you also see on the gates the red and white Tudor rose. Now, it's interesting. According to Shakespeare, the Wars of the Roses started here. King Henry VI came to the throne at the age of 9, a bit of a political crisis, and York and Lancaster had this furious row about the succession. They went into the Temple Garden. York plucked a white rose for his emblem, Lancaster the red, and the battle started. Thousands were dead. At the end of the Civil War, Elizabeth of York married Henry of Lancaster, and the two were stuck together as the Tudor rose. So this really was a place for political networking. This is where the powerful would come on a ring. That's why young men of the aristocratic lineage wanted to come here and complete their education. Old boys from here include Sir Walter Raleigh. He founded the Virginia Company, encouraging people to go across to America to colonize that. And there's a strong connection with America and Middle Temple. And it very badly bombed in World War II, and beautifully restored thanks to monies raised by the English, Canadian and American Bar Associations. If you go inside the hall, you'll find names of people who are responsible for compiling the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States. John Dickinson, penman of the Revolution, was a member here. Sir Francis Drake, also, and he circumnavigated the globe with the Golden Hind and gave part of the ship, which they called the Cupboard, as part of furniture that they use here still. And it's also here where Shakespeare's Twelfth Night was first performed in 1602. You may have seen perhaps the film Shakespeare in Love, with Judi Dench inside playing the Queen. They also used it for the exotic Bombay Hotel when the judge resigned in the first scene, and also Bridget Jones' Diary, because Colin Firth plays a barrister in that. So you're half expecting Dumbledore to come in any minute to sew things up. Anyway, it's here. If you're a pupil barrister, you must come here. You must dine 12 times here. If you don't eat these 12 meals, you do not qualify as a barrister. It used to be 36. They cut it down to 12. The reason for this was the schoolroom. They couldn't afford to print all the books, so you had to learn something here. And they used to summon people that were blowing a trumpet from the stairs. And people would be like, bah, 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 oh, God, it's dinner. They'd drop their drink or their girlfriend, dive in there, and the door's locked, and they can't move. That's exactly what happened. If you're a second late, you've missed it, you're out, that's it. So you take part here sometimes in moots, the mock trials. Quite intimidating, you know. You've got senior judges and barristers listening to you trying out your skills for the first time. One young man was there, and all his notes, he was shaking with fear. And he said, my lord, my unfortunate client... Oh, God, it's the wrong page. I'm so sorry, sorry, yes. My lord, my unfortunate client... God, it's upside down. I'm frightfully terrible, sorry. Yes. my lord, my unfortunate client... I said, no, do carry on. So far, I've been entirely with you.